Happy Black Friday, everybody, and welcome back for another week of Bioactive Live Q&A, where we're trying to answer your questions, get you guys connected with some people with some amazing information. And this week, we have an amazing guest here with us. Johnny from Mindfully Rooted is here to share some information on natural farming and to talk about the transition from Southern California in a totally kind of interesting warm tropical climate of San Diego, and then making a transition, moving up to the Pacific Northwest where things are different, mindset might be different, pests are certainly different. So it's going to be fun to pick your brain on how that's changed for you. I know we were just talking about Mindfully Rooted being the name of your company. And, you know, I think that's super appropriate. And this is going to be a pretty mindful conversation about the things you need to consider when you go into a new environment. So before we begin, Johnny, my name is Mark. I'm from MI Beneficials. Your host, as always, co-hosting with me is Brian from Rubber Ducky Isopods. And we've got Kevin from OK Calyx. Guys, if you like this show and you're here week after week, don't forget to subscribe and like, okay? So, Johnny, been a while. We had you on when Brian and I were doing this. I think it might have predated when Kevin even came on board.
This is the first time that Johnny and I have talked live like this.
That's true. That really is. I mean, like, we interact on social media here and there, but like, this is the first time that like we're actually having a full-on conversation. This is a special moment, man. It's
cool. Two natural farming powerhouses truly here with us tonight. And in two different, completely different regions and microclimates. That's one of the things I love about this show and getting people that are coming from somewhere completely different is that it's a totally different experience you're talking from. It's a different skill set. There's different things to consider. So Johnny, we had you on back when we were on IG Live only and weren't recording these on YouTube. But I wanted to give you an opportunity for anybody who hasn't heard of you. You've been around for a long time, and you used to be really active sharing information and on your journey in natural farming. Can you tell us kind of where you came from, how you started, and kind of where you are now?
Yeah, absolutely. So born and raised in San Diego, cost of living is really expensive out there. So living in an apartment, trying to do natural farming in an apartment, I'll get into that if you guys want to know a little bit more about that history. But that's kind of where it all started for me. I'm a hobby grower, home grower, gardener when I can. Had a little plot of land at my dad's house, backyard gardening and stuff like that. Where I think a lot of like my outdoor pictures, I guess then were actually from my pop's house, where I set up a garden and things like that. I really started off initially using bottled nutrients. I think, what was I mainly using? I was using Cutting Edge Solutions. Like, I used their entire line. I loved the line. It was a great line. Got a lot of respect for that crew. Gave me a lot of good information. That's kind of where like my entry point into growing cannabis was.
Hey, real quick, Johnny, just to show how far you go back, Cutting Edge Solutions, as far as I understand, was the team that taught Jeff Lowenfels.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, you're talking about like the OG older man.
John, Uncle John,
Yeah, so not obviously everything. Lowenfels has been around for a long time. But some of the deeper stuff is where, you know, Jeff gives his tip of the hat to. So I just wanted to show more people that you've been around for a long, long time, man. So I just wanted to highlight that because, especially in the early days, being in the apartment and now being in a home and doing what you love and all that, that's what we've been around for a long time. And you're just another person. And my kids are calling it receipts, so now I call it. You know, you're showing the receipts. You got it. You got the diplomas on the wall. So I want more people that are more in my world now, the bioactive reptile side, to realize that you're an OG.
I appreciate
that.
Cutting edge
solutions. What did you?
Yeah,
call
that. That was the name of. Yeah, that's the name of the company. Okay. Yeah. So I used to use a lot of their bottled nutrients, but like where my transition into like natural farming really came into is like transitioning from cannabis into food. being in an apartment, I can only pop so many seeds. I can only grow so many plants. So if I wanted to dive into more of the plant world, I needed to an outdoor space. And at the time, do something a little bit more legal that I could do, you know, at a family member's house, and they're not gonna, I guess, trip about it. So starting pepper seeds, tomato seeds, all kinds of seeds. And then I realized, well, I can't use these bottled nutrients on that. It's just gonna be way too expensive. So that was kind of that transition to where, when I started using, more like compost and, things of that nature, and just like bagged fertilizer from, you know, the gardening store, led me to that transition. And then once I was able to do that, then I was like, well, why can't I just apply that to cannabis as well? And that's where that deep, deep rabbit hole really started with natural farming. And that led me into more like the Korean natural farming style, just given kind of what my background is. That style of growing really spoke to me because it was really based off of observation. And I think
who
that
are you learning that, from, sorry, Johnny, who are you learning from at the time then when you're getting into it? Are you looking at books, looking at videos?
So I started off looking at some of the videos. My very, very first introduction from it was from Drake from the, was it like Pure Hawaii? I think is what his old account used to be or something like that. And then that led me to Chris Trump. And then that led me to a class in Riverside, California, where the Cho family came in and did a whole introductory. And that was my like level one, I guess, introductory into it was doing one of their classes. And then from there, that took off for me. Being able to ask questions, get things like hands-on experience with it. Granted, it was in a classroom and some outdoor stuff, but then I really dove more into like the literature and things like that. So a lot of it for me is like self-taught, and I try to interact with as many people as I can, just to kind of gather information and really learn from like other people's style, what their mistakes are, what they tried, what they didn't try. Some people are more forthcoming with the information. Some people aren't. And that's just kind of the nature of, you know, how people can be. So that's one of the reasons why like I try to be as forthcoming as I can with information, because I recognize like how difficult it was for me to find straight answers with a lot of this stuff. So yeah, if anybody has questions, please reach out to me. I'll try to help you where I can, or at least try to guide you and point you to who might have that information.
That's why we love this. That's why we love this platform, because it is a chance to ask direct questions. And that's a great point, Johnny. The reason we're here is to connect you guys with Johnny. So if you guys do have questions about anything that he's talking about through this whole thing, please do ask the questions. It's a unique experience to be able to ask questions direct and get an actual answer. The ambiguity is something that drives all of us, I think, insane. while Johnny cleans up over there.
Is that a kombucha explosion?
Yeah, I turned it to get the stuff on the bottom up, and it just...
Yeah, that's what I thought I watched. It's the very thing.
It's exactly what you saw.
So, Johnny, I feel like... So, when you decided to go down, like, the kind of the Korean, the KNF, if you will, avenue, was, like, smells a consideration at that time? Because it seems like KNF lends itself beautifully to an apartment grower if you're trying to go natural, because there's not a ton of a wild... you know, anaerobic smells going on.
You know, as long as you don't mind the smell of yeast, like, you're good. I built a wooden box out of cedar fencing pallets, or not pallets, fencing panels, or whatever they are. Like, I'm not a carpenter at all. I know how to use a screwdriver, and I know how to drill. Like building stuff isn't my strong suit. But I built it. I built something. It wasn't straight, but it worked. And basically just built like a little platform that I used, a quarter, like literally a quarter, in between each slot, just to create a little bit of a gap, an even gap in between each slot on the bottom to let airflow kind of come in. And I built it big enough to be able to turn a pile from one side to the next. And I was able to do that. It's crazy to say, but like when I used to work like this on screen, be right behind me. Yeah, which is basically I went to like a coffee roaster spot and got a couple burlap bags, cut them, and use it as my covering, just to kind of protect the top. But at the same time, allow it to be breathable so that essentially, like, I've used a tarp before over the top, but it creates condensation and it just drips back down. So it just makes it wet again. And so by putting a burlap bag over the top, it kept some of the condensation, but it also allowed it to breathe. So over time it could kind of dry out. So yeah, so as long as you don't mind the smell of yeast and like breadish type stuff, given that I was using wheat bran and rice bran in an apartment, it worked well. Just make sure you don't have any kind of like rodent problems and you should be all right. So that, and then like the fermented plant juices worked really well. Jadam, on the other hand, worked a little bit indoors, but it's, for me, in my size of the place that I was at, it wasn't conducive to have buckets of fertilizer in my office to pour on my plants. It just, I left that for my outdoor stuff.
It just doesn't work.
Yeah. And Kev, like, that's, you know, admittedly, that's a perspective that we lose sometimes on this show, is being the guy in the apartment trying to do this thing. So that's why I honestly think that set of information is just as valuable as anything else you have succeeding in, you know, running a successful natural farming program indoors in an apartment. And you said you were in San Diego. So, you know, we can go as far down the rabbit hole, I guess, as we want, but like, just right off the clip, a question I would have would be, you know, someone living in an apartment, where are you putting your IMO collection boxes? Where's that coming from? Like, are you going to find a park, or is it, you know?
So like that? I'd go out to the mountains. So in Southern California, there's a couple of national forests. San Bernardino National Forest was kind of like where people go skiing for like Big Bear, if you've ever heard of that resort. That's a big national forest. You go place boxes out there if you're going hiking. In Southern California, in San Diego, there's an area called like Palomar, where it's like I went to like sixth grade camp as like a kid. And we'd go hiking out there, go camping. So what I did is whenever we went camping, I would take that opportunity to go place boxes out. Or if we were going, and if we were going to be out there long enough, then I would leave those out there to collect them, or sometimes drive out early, place them, and then collect them when we're out there. But what I found to be the most successful and the easiest for me, which isn't the traditional way to do it, but it still really worked for me, was bringing material home. So I would bring a sandbag, for instance, and I would just grab material that had mycelium on it or that looked like it was starting to decompose, and put all of those in there and then just carry it in a backpack. And then when I got home, I would use a cardboard box, create a forest floor on the cardboard box with the material and place my collection box on top and then just cover it with burlap so that way it could still breathe, but light isn't penetrating as much. And that was really nice because I could easily just, you know, if I had left it on the floor next to me, I could just peel over the the paper towel that I put over the box, and I could see the fuzz starting to grow, and I could time it. And just as soon as I saw that it was ready, cool, pull it, and then mix it in brown sugar to stabilize it, and then boom, it goes on my shelf. So to me, that's where I had the most success. The most successful collections were that way because I could monitor them and pull them exactly when I thought they were ready to go.
That's a huge tip for anybody growing in an apartment right there. And there's a follow-up question if someone wants to just kind of know what your setup looked like. We'll get into that in a second. But just kind of recap, I mean, that like meshes what Kevin loves doing, which is to go collect your amazing natural goodies with all the mycelium and stuff. And just having if you really think about it, like that, grabbing that is going to be far less pathogen filled and nasty for something like an apartment space than going outside or going to your toilet or go, you know what I mean? Like just going out and rubbing your feet on the pavement where it's just collecting crap. You know what I mean? So getting over the phobia of like dirt, you know, having a spot, because how would you said you laid out cardboard. Would you do it like a bathroom?
Or no, I just didn't like a garage. Not like in a box, man. Like just get a cardboard box and tape up the bottom, right? Like as if you're gonna put shit in it. But instead of putting shit in it, you put your forest floor and then your collection box in. That's it. And I would it's just literally put it forest. Like, yeah. And I would just put it like, dude, this office that I had that I used to work out of, I had two tents in there, like a rack in there with all of my fermentations. I used to dry in the same space. Like, I don't know how I made it work, but I made it work for a couple of years while I lived there. And, but yeah, it was just a box that I put, like you could, I don't know, a foot by 2 foot box, enough clearance room on the outside so you can have some shit. You could even use, like a can flat. I don't know what the actual name is, but like where like the cardboard box that they put six packs in, you know what I mean? Like you could just use something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
First floor thing and just put your box on top and just cover it with something so it protects it from a little bit of light or filter some of the light going through, and that would work. It's worked for me plenty of times.
And here's a way, guys, if you're really worried about, like, you know, roly-polies, grays, isopods, stuff like that, like, here's a way when we talk about processing, you know, here's another way that you can process your material into usable microbes that can be used without the concern of something like roly-polies as an example, because that really is a concern down road, and it comes from things like hard inputs that you're putting in. So it's like anything from worm castings to, it can be some directly outside, it can be from a bag of worm castings. So great way to process. A question I had for you, because you talked about collecting from like the San Bernardino Mountains. I've actually been there. I used to live in Redlands, California. Oh. So I've been up the Big Bear and stuff like that. And I know that like it might have been just the season that we were in, but it was really dry up there.
It's super dry.
Yeah, especially compared down to like San Diego, where it's consistently got a pretty high relative humidity compared to the – it's a desert, right? So did you find better success with your IMO collections coming from like the forests up in the mountains like – San Bernardino, where it's a little bit different than your microclimate? Were you getting better results out of stuff that was coming like maybe a little bit closer to home, or maybe like in that same climate region?
I don't think I understand your question.
Like, were you putting boxes out like in San Diego, area where it's like warm, you know, it's like 80 degrees and like, you know, 60% humidity because it's right next to the ocean. Super, I guess I used to live in the desert. So when I would drive to San Diego, it felt like moist. It felt different.
I got you.
It smelled different. It felt different. So I just was wondering, for somebody like collecting microbes from a different region, like, is there any correlation? Are you seeing better results with those like closer to home microbes, I guess?
You know, I never really placed boxes out in the city. I didn't see the point. Like it just seemed, I didn't see the purpose for it. I tried it a couple times in like some trees that were in like my dad's neighborhood, but I'm like, I don't know what I'm collecting here. It's just like, I'm finding a bunch of trash like around and stuff like that. So I'm like, I didn't really bother. So most of my collections, actually all of my successful collections that I use for any of the IMO, that if anybody's ever gone IMO from me or from Brian, has come from, if it was from Southern California, it came from either Palomar or San Bernardino or Idlewild like areas. Like those are the mountain ranges and like the towns that they kind of came from. but no, like I lived a block from the beach in San Diego, and there's nowhere that I felt comfortable collecting IMO out there that I felt like would supersede what I could find out in the mountains. And I never did side by sides with any of the stuff. I didn't have the space or the time to see, does this microbe impact that, or what am I collecting in from here versus there? Just granted that, you know, underneath the microscope, at least for me with my novice level of understanding microscopy, I'm not going to be able to differentiate the subtle differences that I'm going to see in that.
It's a testament to the natural, you know, the power of natural microbes, really, because it is a bit of a drastic change coming from up in elevation up there in California down to a block from the beach. Right. Talk about a big change. So testament to really just the power of using IMO. If you've got it, use it, baby. You know, it can come from Oklahoma, it can come from Southern California, it can come from New England. I think a diversity is always better. So anyways, let's get to that question that Mother I Love Flowers on Instagram had about your, like, your actual grow setup in the apartment. Let's talk about that for a second.
Yeah, so I ran a 2x4 tent and a 2x2 tent. I had a 100-gallon bed inside of a 2x4 tent. I basically put a rock sand layer at the bottom. And then I basically put like a peat-based medium on the whole way through to the top. And then on top of that, I mulch heavy, mulch heavy, mulch heavy. Like, to me, mulch is king. That was basically what my setup was. And I would put netting across the top, be able to train plants. If you go through my IG account and look through stuff from, let's see, like early, from like 2023 and before, you'll see all of my stuff where I was kind of growing stuff in that tent, in that bed. Currently, I'm not using that bed. I realized that when I needed to move it, because we were going to have a house inspection, removing 100 gallons of soil out of an apartment, on the second story apartment, into the garage, which was a block away, was very difficult to do, and very time consuming and very stressful. So I transitioned to that, to using pots, so it's easier to pick up and move if I need to tear anything down, given that I'm not a homeowner. And the gray area of cannabis, even though it's legal, right? So
so I have a question. That's a big one. Set up then. Absolutely. What kind of, eventually, were you trying to kind of create your own soils as you go out and grab stuff from Mother Nature and start composting and things like that? Did you... And did that happen in the apartment? And if it did you, how much material would you have to get? Like a couple of totes worth, you know, did that work for you? You know, cause if it's what you just described, eventually you can make enough to kind of, to stabilize and not really have to keep pumping things out, but use what you've got and chill out a bit. So talk about that.
Yeah. So with my journey into going to those beds, I wanted to kind of keep things as, I guess, as controlled as possible. So I was using recipes that I had found online on building soil. So mainly using like a peat and a fraction of compost and some kind of aeration material. So your typical, like a Coots mix type of idea. Luckily I had a single carport garage that I could mix soil in on a tarp, or, my lady was kind enough to allow me to put a tarp out in the living room and flip soil in the living room so I could fill the bed and things like that. So I got to give props to her for being cool with all of that nonsense, when all that was happening. I never went out to the forest to collect material to make soil. I think that if people started doing that, especially grabbing totes and totes of that, it would be a little much. So for me, I was just kind of using a peat-based soil that I would continue to amend and using. And that's where a lot of things have transitioned for me now, because I was trying to find as much material as I could out there. But it was really difficult to find material building community out in Southern California. Especially being in an apartment. So like trying to find raw materials that I wasn't having to pay for was difficult.
It's also a huge difference when you talk about the mountains out in California, when it comes to the abundance of organic matter versus what Kevin and even I have here in Michigan, and what you probably have in Oregon, where you have...
Shit's changed now.
where you have deciduous leaves, at least, which are always constantly regenerating for organic matter, mm-hmm. where you have nuts and acorns and, you know, all sorts of stuff to use that's just going to get broken down anyways that you can collect mindfully. But I love that about you, because, yes, like those forests out there, if you walk around, a lot of time they're like, it's not what you really expect. You know what I mean? They're pretty picked through when it comes to like organic matter from whatever natural causes, burns, fires from a few years ago, 10 years ago. So yeah, it's a little different.
Hey, Johnny, what floor were you on? Were you on a bottom floor, a second floor, or something like that?
Second floor, yeah. All
right. So you're toting everything to the second floor too.
Yep, 5 gallon buckets, man. Farmer carries five gallon buckets up and down stairs and things like that. Was a little bit of a pain in the ass. But no, it's like I was able to, at my pop's house, I was able to get a chip drop. If you guys are familiar with chip drop, if you're not, I would highly recommend get connected with chip drop. I had a chip drop sent to my pop's house, and that's where I stored that material. So I was able to use a lot of that for mulching. I was able to use that for food for like my worm bins. I was able to use that to make IMO as like my carbon source and things like that. But aside from like that and like cutting the grass and using, let's say, like the leftover tomato plants and my cucumber plants and things like that, like organic matter wasn't easy to come by unless you're purchasing it in Southern California, at least for me, given where I was living. So yeah, but things are a little bit different now where I'm at now.
That's a good segue. That's a great segue right there, because so Johnny, you know, it's talking about his experience in his apartment in San Diego, second story, the struggles of that. You know, I'm sure that it was always your goal to get out to a house. And it seems like you've achieved that goal, and you've relocated to a really beautiful area of the country that I love, up in Oregon. Yeah. Tell us about that. Like, how have things changed for you?
Do you have a garden? What does your cannabis grow look like? Y'all at?
Yeah, man. Transition's been big. I was terrified to move out of Southern California, just given that's where I'm from, and being able to surf and hang out and at the beach and stuff. But honestly, like looking back at it, I don't plan on ever moving back. It's amazing up here in the Pacific Northwest. People say it rains a lot. Well, I like it. It's been really cool for us. But I think like the biggest change has been like access to organic material and community. I think community is a really, really big one that we miss. And this is why I'm glad that we have platforms like this that kind of help bring people together. But having, outside of an online community, actually having like a physical community around you that you can access materials from, share knowledge with, share resources with, I think is really, really important. And that's what's changed for me, is access to community, access to resources, access to, like, I have enough water. Like, water is not a limiting factor in the Pacific Northwest. Especially
you
over
can't
time.
You can't find running water in talk about San Bernardino Mountains. You literally can't. No. You can find a trickle of a stream. It's really dry out there.
So like being out here, that's where a lot of things have changed. Is like if you start understanding what resources we have, you can start creating situations that allow you to maximize those resources as much as possible. It's really disheartening driving around the areas that I live in, a bunch of farmland, and seeing a lot of uncovered soil, seeing people tilling, seeing things you can see the erosion happening on some of the fields as I'm driving down the highway. And it's pretty disheartening, just given the amount of water that we have, and you see people then irrigating in the summer. But I'm like, if you did a couple things differently, there's a good chance that you could actually use that soil to pull in that moisture, hold that water, and allow your plants to essentially dive their roots deeper to access that water later in the season when they're going to need them. But that's not my area, given that I'm not a farmer, and I've never worked on that scale or anything like that. So I guess I want to make sure I stay in my lane in that piece.
Well, and in here in Michigan, it's the exact same story. And I think you have to travel farther, maybe even to find those organic farms that are doing it right. You know, there's definitely some beacons of hope around. But like you said, having the physical community beyond, you know, this online thing, I think having actual things to trade one another, to be able to give each other a hand when you need it. Because when you have one person doing work versus two, it's not 2x the work. I mean, if you've ever worked with a good partner, you know it's 4 to 10x, you know, depending on how you're both moving. So it's just the testament of the community. So are you finding better community up there in Oregon?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess I didn't share this before too, but like a natural farming for me was really my way of capturing microbes. I had remember watching some podcast someone did on future cannabis where they talked about like the Oregon Department of Agriculture, where they would do testing on microbial products. And I remember looking through that and seeing
that was us for sure, bro.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, it was you and who? Whenever one of the first shows
we were talking about, we were talking to Jeremy Silva because he was one of the first ones to bring it up. So that's actually where I learned it from.
Yeah, that's who.
But that's at the beginning when people started to realize that even some of the capillator products and stuff might not necessarily be as hyped and as worthwhile as claimed among other products. It was like basically all microbial products that were tested.
So yeah, I don't know any specific product, but I just remember seeing that and feeling really disheartened with that, like with what that looked like and what that was sharing with me. And I'm like, well, if that's the case, I'm just gonna go collect them myself. And if I get 50%, then I get 50%. It's 50% more than I had before. Like, it is what it is. And I just figured it was like, if I'm gonna go spend my money, I'd rather go spend it on something else that at least has more of a guarantee to it. So even in apartment, a lot of it was just microbiology and some of the ferments that I would use as foliar sprays, as tonics for plants and things like that. But the IMO for me was like the big, big piece. Now I feel like I'm able to expand a little bit more where I'm able to use a lot more natural resources. Like I have, for instance, I have a neighbor that I share a lot of knowledge with him. He has a really big garden. Not a farm per se, but like he does a lot of row cropping he lives on an acre and does a bunch of work out there. And so I share a lot of knowledge with him. He shares resources with me. So hey, we get together. John, yeah.
How are you utilizing your IMO whenever you're capturing it in your apartment? And then how are you utilizing it now? Like taking it to IMO 2 to IMO 3, do you just put it straight into soil? You make teas with it. How are you using it?
So I take it to IMO 3 and I leave it at IMO 3. I don't typically take it to IMO 4. This next year, I plan on going to IMO 4 because what I'm doing, we live in a really clay heavy area. So I don't want to dig up the clay and have to break it up to be able to use it. But we do have a lot of moles, and moles dig up this really, really fine, tilled, really fluffy soil that just sits at the top. So what I've been doing, what I was doing in this over the summer and the spring was collecting that stuff and putting it into buckets. And then just having a couple buckets in my garage. So come this next spring, I can use that as my soil for my IMO4. That way I'm not disturbing the soil. I'm not disturbing anything. The moles disturbed it for me and I'm just picking up what they disturbed and I'm gonna use that. So that's my next piece.
That's a great little gold bar right there, guys, because you all know plenty of y'all got moles in your yard. And another thing is you see little mittens where worms come up and push those little bits of dirt and poop up. You know, you can grab all that stuff. Like Johnny said, put it in a bucket, man. And that's just native soil, basically. You combine that with your IMO3 and you can cook it again. I actually don't cook it. I just I create a texture with it that I can grow in. The IMO3 and that native soil post, you know. Just create the texture I want, and then that's when I start growing in it. So
that doesn't get too hot for you? I feel like that's temperature would skyrocket, no?
Nope, it always works.
That's what's up, man. Yeah, that's something I want to mess around with more, is like making my own soils and trying to get a little bit more away from peat as much as I can. But yeah, that's how I mainly use IMO, is through IMO 3. I top dress with it, especially during the winter time. I don't brew a lot of teas. Like right now I have a little bit of grow going and I have a little container sitting like over here on one of my shelves. That's just IMO that I just kind of sprinkle onto the top and water it in. It's just cold as fuck outside and I'm not trying to be washing my buckets and washing all that stuff out in the cold. So during the winter time when I'm growing indoors, I don't make a lot of teas. I just top dress it and that's really it. During the summertime though, yes, I do brew teas in my garage and use the IMO3 to do that and to your typical like limo tea. So yeah, so like your IMO, fermented plant juice, OHN, seawater, vinegar, humic acid, things like that. So that's primarily how I use it.
And so do you now have a garden that you grow in? Tell us about
growing. Yeah.
What do you grow? How do you grow?
So we grow a lot of what we want to eat. So when we lived at my dad's house, I was like, oh, I want to grow all these different fancy plants and see what we end up. We need to eat half of that shit. Like I think we grew like 4 eggplant plants 1 year and I ate 1 eggplant. Like that was a waste of space for me. So each year I feel like we're learning more of like what we are running out of quicker and what we actually want to have and what we're spending our money on. So going back to like this idea of being mindful, like paying attention to where you're spending your money at the grocery store when it comes to produce and focusing your time on growing those to save yourself the money for one, and then also give you more nutritional density in your food because you're growing yourself. So that's we especially, grow.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go for it, man.
I was just going to say that's especially important, a really good point, but it's especially important for people like me who don't have a huge plot. I mean, I have only a couple hundred square feet of bed space, maybe a little more than that, but I do have to be mindful because like you said, you know, I don't know why I keep growing 5 tomato plants. You know, I'm not like a huge tomato fan. We'll right. use them for whatever reasons and or they fall, but yeah, it's like that could be used elsewhere.
Right. So we did a lot of that too, where we were growing a lot of just stuff that we weren't eating. So we've made the transition slowly to growing more like things like onions, garlic, potatoes, tomatoes, cucumbers, peas, carrots, beets, lettuces, broccoli, things like that we actually consume, or things that we like to juice and things like that. And seed saving. I know we were talking about this a little bit before we kind of got on, kind of in a way to kind of stick it to the man, right? Like you really want to start saving some money, start seed saving, grow your same varieties. Like you can keep counting on going to, you know, your seed catalog, but that one heirloom tomato or that F1 variety that you really liked, they're not going to keep it forever. So you want to keep it, grow it, keep your seeds and grow them over generations or store them in the fridge and keep them for, you know, 10 years, 20 years on the line.
And we had Andy from Great Lakes Grease on last week, and that was like his big thing. That's like his thing, right? Is collecting rare, old, almost lost genetics. Like he knew somebody that was in Ghana and texted them and asked them to please try to find a melon that was only grown in Ghana and grab one of the melons and get some seeds out of it, bring them back. And he's actually That's grows cool. these melons. They grow like 50 to 75 pounds in Michigan. But you know, his whole thing was that by looking for some old genetics and by saving your seeds, I guess let's break that into two things. By looking for old genetics, you can actually help to preserve like traditional genetics because slowly those types of things are being phased out as these small businesses close and don't have the same genetics to offer. You can actually carry the torch on to add on to the saving of cost for you and your family, tremendous cost savings. But the other thing that he was saying was that year after year, if you save your produce seeds, they just keep getting better. They keep getting more resilient. They keep getting more robust and more fruitful. So just another consideration there and a really good point. People don't want to talk about or hear about a lot. As much as they love to talk about and hear about cannabis growing.
Right.
But food, we can't live without, folks. So if you can nail the food growing thing and get on the homestead thing where you're saving cost for you and your family, especially seasonally, that's a major flex in my book.
Yeah.
I'm looking at you like, you know, your daddy big dick. if you're you know, providing for your family for most of the year, you know, you're top dog in my book. So yeah.
Yeah. So we have, when we moved into this spot, we're renting still. But when we moved into this spot, we have 3 garden beds that were pre-built, that I'm gonna have to do some work on in late winter, to get them ready for the spring. But we also were finding we started expanding outside of that into pots, into random containers that we would find on the property. Also finding spots that we could fill in or dig out around like a fence line that we could use the fence as trellising. But really, going back to like one of the biggest things that changed for me, and I think this is a really big piece for me, is don't rush into it. Like, really take some time to observe. Like, really, really observe your environment, observe where you think you might want to put things, to understand the climate, especially for me moving from Southern California to the Pacific Northwest. This is a new climate for me. So each day was a new experience into that new season, for that first year. So we put plants in certain places, realized, oh, this spot gets more sun. Oh, this is a south-facing wall. I can put things that like more heat here. Oh, boom, we get to this certain part of the year, the sun starts dropping here. Where can this go? And trying to like take like more of like a permaculture like perspective on that, and just viewing the environment as a resource itself and figuring out where you can place things, which made our second year garden a little bit bigger than our first year garden.
So how are you feeding your plants? What are you using? Are you using KNF inputs? Are you doing some Jadam stuff now?
I do a little bit of everything. So I have a couple of Jadam buckets that I use for mainly greens. Green weeds, comfrey goes into one bucket for a little bit of a nitrogen component. We have a tomato bucket. We grow a lot of tomatoes. We eat a lot of tomatoes. We have a tomato bucket. One of our other main sources, we use ash. We use chicken manure. We use compost. I go out to the coast and collect crabs and wash those and break them up to basically make my own crab meal. And then for our calcium sources, I have purchased a bag of oyster shell and gypsum as like to supplement those components into it as well.
You have any neighbors or any community that you trade things with, or you barter with, or do you get?
Absolutely. Yeah. So going back to this idea of like community, this is another really big piece for me, was being able to share information with some of the people that are close to me in proximity and getting resources from them. So we've actually gotten together. Me and my neighbor got together. We built a, what are those called? Basically like a biochar reactor thing, a kiln, I think is what they're called. And we basically got a 55-gallon drum, put another drum on the inside of that, made biochar. We make that during the year. And that's one of the things that we kind of share, but I get all my chicken manure from them. So when he cleans out his chicken coop, it's all the straw with a bunch of droppings on. And then I give him labs in my lab cheese that he feeds to his chickens. I get the manure from him. He gets.
So what do you do with the chicken manure?
That goes in my compost. That goes straight into my compost as my greens, to get that temperature nice and up. So as recently, I was able to get some wood chips. So using that with the wood chips and some biochar, the IMO, leaves are crazy out here, relative to Southern California with palm trees. So that's been another pretty, significant resource for me, is having the access to leaf litter that I've never had.
Once you make that IMO4, you know, I use chicken manure and chicken bedding for my IMO5, my little nitrogen input.
Yeah,
you're hooked up. Well, that's cool that you do have a community you finding all the resources that are around you. That is free. You know, Jadam is ultra low cost. I'm trying to go no or like zero cost, right? That's what you're trying to do, is just eventually you're just like, man, I can make this my own. Once I do a little bit of figuring things out, nature's got so many things available that you can use you know, a variety of them. But yeah, it's really cool to hear you, Johnny, that you actually, that, you know, that's one of my first questions, I think, was what are you going out and getting and using, and what are your resources? So you definitely are very resourceful in getting things. And guys, that is, as Mark says, the flex for me. It's having a great product, and you spent.
Is that what he said? I thought he said it a different way.
Yeah, he always says it certain ways, but he says it something like the goal is. I mean, the goal is, you know, no money and eating your own food and having your own medicine. So you can do it. You just got to look. And, you know, Johnny, I want to take it back real quick, just a bit into the hard times, because when I started OK Calyx Organics, it was because I had so many people saying, can I buy some of what you're making? Because I live in mostly an apartment, but it'd be like a homeowners association. They couldn't do anything, or they might be someplace their wife didn't like it, or they rented. And there were so many reasons that they couldn't sit there and create these things. And so out of a need, you know, I started saying, yeah, heck yeah, I'll sell you all kinds of good stuff, man. I can make a lot of it, and I can make it cheap, and I can hook you up every time. So, you know, growing in an apartment, what – I know you talked about it a bit, but I was still thinking about my question. So if you answered it once already, answer it again. Cool. A lot of people just cannot make stuff in apartments because of the smell, first of all. Second of all, they might live on the second or third floor, and that's a lot of work. And your will be there, but then your body's going to say, nah, we ain't going to do this no more. I'm tired of carrying stuff. And so you're going to start minimizing, or you're going to start adjusting your system and your style. And so what could you make in an apartment that you were able to use and that wasn't offensive or wasn't too hard of work, or you didn't have to go far and find it? You know, what was easy for you to make in an apartment, because this might help somebody in an apartment begin to make some things that they didn't realize.
So a lot of your basic K&F inputs can be made in an apartment. I started off making OHN in 32-ounce mason jars. And that'll last someone in an apartment a very long time, right? You will make, what is that, six liters of it, so a little under 2 gallons. And you're using this at, you know, 1 milliliter. 4 mils a gallon of water, like that's going to last you a long fucking time. So that was one of the inputs that, to me, it's very time consuming. A lot of trial and error. I mean, now I'm sitting on like 30 gallons of it in my garage. So like, I'm not going to be making this shit for a long time. So if anybody wants any, I have like 2-year-old, like aged vintage, like OHN sitting in my garage at this point. But I won't be making that for a while. But so like OHN is really easy. Fermented plant juices, I think, are really, really easy to make in that way. Labs is another one, I think, that's huge. If you're not making labs, start making labs. That is one of the easiest things to make. And I think that like an easy introductory into like natural farming type techniques or just any kind of microbial products, like that's very, very low hanging fruit. Go find yourself some cheap milk, go get some rice and a vessel. Like you could just use like a mason jar to do that in, and then a bucket or a bigger mason jar. So I'd say those. Vinegars, I would probably just buy myself. I've made them before. If you make a fermented plant juice, think about the amount of liquid that you pull out, multiply that by about roughly 2, and pour that amount of water in over the material. Just make sure it's submerged, cover it, let it sit for 2 months. You'll see a SCOBY start growing, extract it, and now you have your vinegar that you can use. So one of the ones that I like to use that I did in an apartment, granted I did have a little bit of area outside where I, at my dad's house where I was able to grow comfrey, was make a comfrey fermented plant juice, which will extract certain mineral contents through that process, but also making a vinegar from it will also extract other minerals from that process. The acidity will create its own reaction and further extract. So now you can have comfrey in a fermented plant version and in a vinegar version, which have similar mineral content, but also will have different mineral contents, given that they're being extracted in 2 different ways. So you can further process it even more.
How do you feel about using like, I noticed I didn't follow up with Marco on it, but I mentioned EM, right? Effective mm-hmm. microorganisms.
Yeah.
And he seemed to be more favorable to labs. And so I guess I don't want to get into that if there's, and maybe I was reading too far into it, but I've noticed that making like what they call fermented plant extracts, right? So that's using EM, sure. EM sugar, and which is generally molasses. But I've noticed that making that, because we make a cannabis specific FPE that's made from like post wash cannabis buds. Cool. And that right there to me is like probably one of the least offensive next to like labs. Cause when you make labs, like it's very unoffensive.
It's very unoffensive, but also yeah. fermented plant extracts aren't offensive. In my opinion, aren't offensive either. I've made it out of pumpkin. That one came out really nice. It didn't smell. I'm actually making one right here on my shelf out of alfalfa. Actually, let me grab it real quick. I'll show it to you. Being in an apartment, like, this is it.
Yeah, look how cool that is. I mean,
so like, there you this go. This is 2 weeks old. It's done fermenting. I'm gonna pull it. I just haven't strained it yet. But this was like two ounces of alfalfa, water, molasses, and lactic acid bacteria.
Why do you have a bubbler on it, Johnny? Why do you have a bubbler on it?
This thing?
Yeah.
That's my airlock. So essentially,
why do you have that on there?
Word. So essentially what this is, I want to make sure that the CO2 that the microbes are creating, they essentially creates a little protection layer over the top of this solution. So what this does is it allows the air to escape, but no air to come in. So CO2 pressure can escape out and I never have to check it. I don't have to worry about the glass bottom breaking. So being in an apartment, I highly, highly recommend to put an airlock. Do not think that you're going to remember to let this breathe every single day. You may get busy. You may go do other shit. Leave this on a shelf in an apartment and you come back and this sugary mess is all over the place and it's a pain in the ass to clean up.
Yeah. When I used to make beer, I made a real high ABV. I was trying to go about 12% beer, and I was assuming it was done. Yeah, look at that sucker. It's about to blow up.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I had a glass jar explode in our kitchen, and it just blew beer everywhere.
So in an apartment, just take those extra precautions is kind of the way that I look at it. Like I have another thing too. I have a bucket down here that I'm making bokashi with. Same thing, I have an airlock on that too. Granted, that's not going to make a mess the same way that a liquid will, but there's just little things that I think that's really helpful. It also shows when the fermentation process is kind of stopped as well, because you can see the water level kind of shift back and move versus when it's still active. So like I'm making bokashi drain in a 5 gallon bucket with an airlock on there as well, and I can hear it bubbling as we're having our conversation, and in a couple of weeks that'll be done. It'll kind of even out a little bit more. And then I can pull it and use it or dry it out next. So does that answer your question? I know we kind of diverted off a little bit from the original question.
Totally.
Yeah, I think some of the things that I'm trying to get into.
That's something that's really important and something that scares a lot of people away when it comes to delving into like natural farming. You know, and if like the first thing you see is like making a bucket of JLF, right? And you live in a house with a wife and kids and you're just starting this thing off and you throw some, you know, alfalfa, let's say it's alfalfa in a bucket sealed in the basement, leave it there for 2 months, like it says, you know, or whatever, longer the better. You pop that thing and you're instantly, you hear sirens coming down the street because your wife thinks you're dead in the basement. And the smell is so bad that you know, you question, it's funny and everything, but like you question doing organics, right? So I think it's a really important perspective to tamper down any thoughts that like, And I guess, like, also you can't be afraid of a little bit of a stink too, because there's going to be mistakes made along the way with these things. I feel like anybody that's probably tried making these things has made those mistakes and smelled them. So as long as you've got a quick drain to drop it down or somewhere to get rid of it, or if you're like Kevin and like me, honestly, and or like anybody, probably you too, Johnny, at this point with the backyard, the smellier it is, I'm not necessarily scared. I'm just going to probably go dilute it down and go water it in and get rid of it that way.
Just given that it's outside, but like trying to spray or like use JLFs indoors, the smell will stick around for 24 to 48 hours. You better have a carbon filter on that shit and airing out. So if not, it's gonna smell in your room when you have that in there.
Yeah, and you've got to bring a large bucket of it in there to water. And as that bucket's sitting there, just stinking the whole place up. Yeah.
So a lot of these, so when I grew indoors, a lot of my stuff was more so like just traditional organic inputs. But I don't buy pre-mixed fertilizers. A lot of things, it's me either shotgunning, approaching single source fertilizers, or getting a soil test done and adding what I need. And the reason I like to do that is because it gives me the information, what is it that I'm putting in? So I have an understanding of what the role of that particular input plays in the system versus a bag that says, you know, number, this is what it is. But yeah, I think Mark, you had asked me a question about like labs and EM1. I don't have a preference. But what Kevin was saying earlier, free is better to me. I'm not going to go buy EM1 when I can make labs. That's just, to me, I just don't see the purpose. Does it have a couple of extra things that might be beneficial? Sure.
So I have a question. Works
great.
You went, John, you said you got to go to Master Cho's class and study with them and learn the ways that K&F do things. And they do have their steps and their methods and measurements and all that stuff. So having done that years ago, and now you've moved from one environment to another one, do you find there are any input creations that you have changed, or you learned one way and now you maybe still do it similarly, but you've kind of said, I don't have to do this? Or are there some changes in the way you make inputs now as opposed to then?
No, I've actually kept it the same.
Nice.
It's been shared with me. Sorry, say that one more time.
I would assume that, man. Well, that's the thing about KNF. It's like that's the process, you know. And
right.
I would, like, I don't know. The way I am, I'd be like, man, I'm gonna cut out whatever I can and see if it'll still work, you know, things like that.
For sure.
Go ahead, continue to talk. You kept it the same. And is there a reason you kept it? Simply because you found it work, or simply because that's how you've been taught and you like to follow the method?
I didn't want to create more variables for myself. So if something was going to work, I wanted to just keep it the same so I could at least eliminate that variable, just given that the inputs themselves can have their already high levels of variability batch by batch. But if I can keep my process in a similar way, I can eliminate that variable so I can understand that, well, is it that I changed this input that I'm now sitting on X amount of material in that I'm have a small garden that I'm having to use this in, that I'm now going to have to dump this in my compost? Or if I kept it the same, then my guess is like, okay, well, this wasn't the issue. If something happened, then maybe it's this, or this. So for me, that's why I've just kind of kept it the way it sat. Way that it was taught to me.
Introduces way less variables. Right. Yeah, it's just a good method to get into and follow. That's for sure.
Yeah, so it's my perspective, my opinion, that if you are getting into natural farming, find a system, learn the system before you start making deviations to the system. So you can test yourself to see, does this system work for you? And maybe there's going to be changes that you have to make for yourself within that system to make it work for you. But I would say try to stick to as true of the system as you can initially before you start making deviations from it to see what you think. Because I just see a lot of times people's like, oh, this doesn't work. Well, you didn't do it the way that it was taught. So is it that what you're trying to do didn't work, or did we miss a step? Or it just adds too much complication, in my opinion, in that way.
So,
go ahead, Mark. Sorry.
Yeah, no worries at all. So you mentioned that you guys made biochar, and one of the things that you guys probably have an abundance of out there in the Pacific Northwest, well, not just wood, but like hardwood, you know, which would be probably one of your more ideal things for making biochar. And I think we talked with a guy named Cuauhtemoc Villa, who lives out in Oregon. He's a big proponent of using EM and biochar and charging his biochar with EM. And one of the things that he talked about was that, you know, cannabis stocks are one of the hottest burning woods, if you will, pulps or whatever you want, plants, if you will. So it creates the most carbon, the most energy in the char. It's like the most ideal char, if you will, next to hardwood, right? So that kind of ties into what Mark Nelson's question is, which is, can I load my canna stocks in my JLF or start something new with it, like make biochar? And so I wanted to kind of flip that over to you. That's what, you know, Cuauhtemoc does. That's one option with your stocks. What do you do with your cannabis stocks? Are you making them in a JLF?
I compost mine. Just because for a long time, woody material was really hard for me to come by. So any woody material that I could get a hold of, I would put into my compost.
Shred it down, or do you just put it whole stock?
I don't have a chipper, so I would just I would just take my clippers and just clip as much as I can before it got until I got to the point where it got a little too thick and I can't necessarily cut them. And then those I just kind of throw into the compost. It'll add a little bit of aeration in there. But yeah, like by making biochar out of them would be great. Any waste material that you have, you can make biochar with. Like I think using wood, hardwood is, yes, maybe it's ideal. But this goes back to just observing your environment and seeing what you actually have access to and using what's available. So for me, like I've grown sunflowers and we use sunflower stalks to make biochar with. We've thrown cannabis stalks in there, but it's not like what we save them for. We find pallets and we'll use pallets because that's what we found accessible to us. We've used wood that, you know, my neighbor went and helped someone take down a tree and where he dried out some wood and we cut some of that up with a handsaw and threw it into our kiln and burned that. We're just trying to use whatever we can because at the end of the day, we're trying to hold as much carbon as we can to put that carbon back into the soil. So that way the microbes have a little hotel to sleep in and to colonize and things like that to kind of build the soil up over time. So I'm a huge proponent of biochar. That's one of the things that I was able to share with my neighbor, that he'd never heard of it. And I moved in and we started talking and he showed me his garden and we started talking about ways that we can, you know, add stuff to his garden. He's a big natural farmer too. So adding IMO into his garden, adding biochar into his garden, showing him how to make biochar. And I mean, you can charge it a ton of different ways. I throw the kitchen sink at my biochar. I'll throw JLS on it. I'll throw fish amino acids. I'll throw vinegars on there. I have a bucket filled with biochar that I just piss in too. And like over time as that, and then when I need it, it's all cooked and ready to go. And I just add it into my soil. So like even right now, all of my pots that I was growing in over the spring or over the summer and spring, I've dumped onto a tarp in my garage so I could remix and re-amend it. But then I have a biochar bucket sitting right there that I'm peeing into. So when I need it, I can just pull that biochar and add it to my soil and it's charged and ready to go. So it doesn't strip the nitrogen from the amendments that are in that I paid a lab test to tell me that I needed that would then get stripped by the biochar.
And so. The other thing that was really kind of interesting that I got from talking with Cuauhtemoc, who's like this huge proponent of like traditional, indigenous practices from hundreds of years ago from like his Native American ancestors.
Yeah.
And the way that they used to burn. And he talks also about how you can use smaller bramble, right? Like I think he said like blackberry, blueberry bushes were like the best. Because
yeah, dude, blackberries are in abundance out here, man.
Dude, and Brian, do you remember? I don't remember why he explained, but one of the reasons was because the branches are so small, it creates char that is like really, really fine. So it works itself down
inside
the soil. Yeah,
it's what's inside that stalk he likes. It's real webby. That's what it was, and it breaks real. So I think it's what it's
sunflowers do something similar too. I don't know. I've never looked at it at that small of level, but sunflowers is the same thing. Like you can just turn into like powder and sand, which makes it easy to kind of disperse. And as it kind of trickles in through like the holes and stuff that the worms are creating and the other, parts of the soil food web that are kind of creating all those aggregates and stuff like that in soil. So yeah, biochar is, I think, one of the bigger additions that I've had since moving out here, because I never had access to making biochar in the city.
It's illegal. I lived in
Southern California. Yeah, I couldn't do it. So out here, we just wait for, oh, it's going to rain tomorrow. Cool. Let's go ahead and set this thing up and we'll burn it overnight. And it's going to rain and it's going to be cold and wet and we'll pull it in the morning. So that's typically what we'll do. We'll put it into buckets and smash it with a big pole and break it into small pieces, run it through a little sift. The big pieces go into the compost, the little stuff's going to a bucket so we can throw it into like a potty mix, which usually we'll use like some peat based mix that we have already, some compost, some of the mole soil, and call it a day.
Are you growing anything specifically to use it as an input?
Am I growing anything specific to use as an input? Comfrey is the one that comes to mind.
Every good grower that I know, guys, has comfrey in their garden in some way, shape, or form. And I'm not saying that good growers don't, it's not a qualification, but I know a lot that seems to be a common thing. Like comfrey, there's something about it, man.
Yeah, comfrey is the only one that I am growing specific for an input. But we also have like an apple tree on our yard, so I don't grow those specifically for an input, but I made vinegar last year with it. We ate a bunch of apples, we made some apple pies, and we made vinegar. So we use kind of that type of stuff. Sunflowers we grow as a pollinator, but at the same time we use that to make for biochar. Or to make water-soluble potassium that way too. So you essentially make biochar, mix that with water, and essentially you're basically spraying on like a light biochar film onto your plants, if you think about it. So that's another one. That's one that I had learned from Chris Trump a while back, that I guess in a sense we grow as an input as well. So
that's one thing to keep in mind, everybody, for things you're planting next year. Is these plants that offer like not just one thing, right? Like a lot of different things. And one of the benefits that I always look for in the plants that I'm growing is, pollinators, because pollinators equals predators. And so when you have a healthy predator and pollinator population, they're going to be there constantly fighting off, a lot of your bad pests that can come in a garden. So one thing to really consider. But then when you can start to consider the fact that, like, also we talked about it in a past episode, but like they're a hyper accumulator, right? Is that the right word, Kevin, Brian? I think it's they're like a hyper dynamic accumulator. Like they're a super accumulator. So they will collect a ton of micronutrients. They're picking up micronutrients, but they're also they're helping with like remediation as well. So if you have toxins in the soil and stuff like that, they pick up traces of that and they render it out. So good stuff to have. And good to good way to consider the plans that you're going to put in, especially when it's not your money, your money plants, like your cannabis, your fruits, your vegetables, the stuff that's feeding you, all your filler plants. Because to me, bare soil, like you said earlier, Johnny, like that's a no-go in my garden. So it's either filled with some sort of mulch, like leaves that I've got stockpiled, or it's full of some sort of cover crop, which is not always going to be like, I generally don't plant like clover seeds, and especially outdoors in my garden there. I think more about, you know, native species, dynamic accumulators, you know, pollinators, stuff like that. So I think that's a good point.
So like we also plant, it's something that we started doing this year. We didn't do it the first year since we moved here, like at the very beginning of the spring. And we were just kind of getting our feet wet. So we, our first garden, our first year is pretty minimal. Just like I said before, from like an observation standpoint, we really wanted to kind of like understand what we were working with first off. But this past year we planted, like a lot of wildflowers that are native to the Pacific Northwest to help bring in, like to essentially create pollinator pockets around our garden. I didn't really deal with any pests. Like I'm sitting on a bunch of Jadam wedding agent that I don't use. I haven't been using it. We're not dealing with pests. Like I see some spider mites here and there, but not enough that I'm going to worry about spraying something. We see thrips here and there, but not enough that I'm spraying anything. Things are in balance. Like you need and you want pests in your garden because those essentially become food for the predators as well. So those are kind of things to kind of think about. But I know Kevin, you'd ask me another thing. So if I grow anything for inputs, one of the other ones that I guess now let's kind of think about it as Mark was saying something was cover crop. At the end of our summer, I started planting fava beans. To use that as our cover crop, to essentially hold or pull the nitrogen that may be left in the soil, hopefully create more nitrogen. So that way, as the leaves that I've used as my mulch to protect my beds over the winter time, we can cut down the fava beans and then add more nitrogen to the carbon. And hopefully that'll increase the rate of decomposition. So that way we can plant in the spring. So in essence, I guess that is kind of another input per se, indirectly that. We're currently growing on a smaller scale. I think next year I definitely have to seed a lot heavier, but we're just kind of playing around and toying with the ideas to kind of see what's working, what's not, timing and stuff like that for now.
Well, what are your two vegetables that are working well for you? Sorry, let me ask that one. What are here in Oklahoma, okra will go to the end of time, man. It goes forever. And we finally had so much okra in the freezer that we just started chopping okra for seed and then just started cutting plants down. But okra goes forever. Tomatoes do great in Oklahoma, cucumbers. You know, what vegetables are working well for you that you eat?
Carrots. Take carrots do really well for us. Potatoes do really well for us. Onions have done really well. Tomatoes did, this was crazy. I pulled, I was able to pull a tomato November 1st. I never thought that was gonna be possible out here. We pulled our last cucumber and our last tomato, like the first, right into November. Like we left it right after Halloween. So we're like, let's just leave it until tomorrow so we can say we pulled it in November 1st. And it was pretty neat to be able to do that. But our nights get pretty cold here. I think we're down into like the mid 30s and it's pretty wet. So like even right now, like we planted carrots, they're not covered. They're just going really, really fucking slow, but they're still alive. They're still going. So that and lettuce, our broccoli still bolted on us for some reason. So lettuce and carrots for right now are like the two vegetables that are still working for us that we're still pulling from our garden. Yeah.
All right. Out of respect for everybody's time too, Johnny, you know, we're obviously going to have you come back on. As Mark was saying, you were one of the original guests that we reached out to because of your time, man. Like what you've given to the community, I think reflects in a weird way, especially with Kevin as well, with how fast your Instagram's grown. And I've always joked that if you're talking about growing or something, that you always should add a zero to whatever your stuff is because of the shadow banning, the things that always seem to happen to a farmer's account. So for you guys to be up there at the 40,000, I think I saw you hit 40,000. I mean, that's incredible, because when you make a post and a couple hundred people like the post, I mean, if you guys know these metrics, that usually means that a couple thousand people saw that post. So there's a real power in what you continue to share, man. And I know that you're finding your own way with your career. And I hope that you come back and kind of even show the basics that you probably think are trivial, because there's almost a whole nother wave here, man, since you've been around for so long, that are wanting to learn this stuff. And they're basically students that are from day one or year one and stuff. All right, real quick, from Rick Easley. He's actually Johnny, a student that I would say here's here week after week. Should I wait for similar outdoor attempts to collect IMO from my indoor grow? And then Kevin and Mark, you guys want to jump in there? That's cool too.
My opinion, no, I wouldn't wait for similar temperatures. Granted, if you run your grow a little warmer, you're going to have to wait a really long time to make that happen. I like to grow, or I'd like to collect them whenever the temperatures are high enough to collect. So it was shared with me once, to wait for temperatures to get above about 42 to 43 degrees. After that, when your night temperatures are above that, you would have fast enough collections. I've had collections that I put out when it's colder and it ends up getting wet because it rained or the dew and things just sit out a little too long, at least in my climate now, just because it's a little bit of a wetter climate. So I typically wait for the nighttime temperatures to get over 42 degrees and then I'm collecting as long as it's dry out and I can.
Yeah, I collect all throughout the year. So I'm always trying to use IMO2 constantly. So I'm always collecting, but I do it all kinds of different methods. Some might be outside. Sometimes you bring that stuff inside. Sometimes you use a bucket, a tote. Sometimes you supply the heat. So it's just there for me, there's lots of ways to gather IMO1, you know, that work.
And this question right here is almost exactly why I was asking you, Johnny, about, like, you know, were you finding better success with like collections that weren't coming from like the dry, cold mountains? You know what I mean? Like, that was kind of, and I think that after hearing your perspective, you're probably one of the better people to speak on that perspective, because who else can drive from next to the ocean 2 hours to the mountains where you're literally, there's snow, you're at 9,000 feet, or I don't know where exactly you were collecting, but like that's where Big Bear is. So, you know, I think you're a great perspective for that question right there. So I like, not a better person to ask that question to. Thank you, Rick.
Yeah, I just think that, yeah, getting, and even like to go further a little bit, what you're asking about, like the, did I see better results? It's hard to tell because I don't ever use one collection in IMO 3. I use all of my collections if they were decent collections, right? So even if I collected something at a local park, but I then grabbed something in the forest, well, which one, like they're both going in there, so they're going to fight it out and figure out who's going to, which dogs are coming out on top. Like that's really up to them. So yeah, I just wait till temperatures get warm enough outside and, where I'm not in basically a monsoon, where it's not raining for a week straight. Just make sure you look at the weather. And if you know, you see weather, some rain in your forecast, just make sure you're prepared for it. And you cover it up or wait till it's done.
Next question from Mark, another gentleman that's here each and every week. Can I load my can of stocks in my JLF so to start something new with it or make biochar?
Can I load my can of stocks in my JLF or start something new with it or make biochar? I think that's what he might say.
So if you have a chipper, you could. I know people that will chip it and use it as a mulch. I think that's a phenomenal way to use it. If you have access to one, I don't, so I don't use that. I personally wouldn't use it in a JLF. I don't see the point. I think it's too much of a woody material for it to really like break down in the time that you're going to want it to break down. So if these are your options, I would probably use it for biochar personally. That way you can kind of suppress, keep that carbon.
Totally agree on that. That's the best way I feel like after talking to Quadamock, you can use your can of stocks.
Yeah.
And then last question from the amusement park king. I don't know if you've seen this gentleman, Johnny, but he's creating like this moat, if you will, in an indoor basement. And he's actually making it work. And that's the pretty cool thing about it, man, is that this dude doesn't give up. So shout out to Yellow Skunk Farms, man. I see you over there doing big things and fixing things. And I think being an engineer and fixing that yourself is a real skill set, because there's a lot of patience and I would say brain power needed to get to the level that you're going to eventually get to. So especially when it comes to labs, because everybody fucks up, talk about putting too much on. How often would you use lab in your indoor grow?
I use it weekly, bi-weekly, whenever I remember. If you're going to make a fermented plant extract, like for instance, like I was talking about, this is alfalfa fermented plant extract. I would use this as a substitute for my labs during my vegetative state. But if I'm using labs, yeah, I would use it weekly as a spray. Use it as a foil, as a soil drench. You don't need to go heavy. If you go, I don't know, there's this, I feel like our culture is kind of like, if some is good, more is better. I feel like that's not like that mentality. Really, like, need to like chill out, like just use a little bit and use it more often and you'll be just fine. Right. So you can use it on a weekly basis. And that's it. That's really where I kind of leave it.
Kevin, you want to add that for me?
Yeah. I have horsetail extract in my spray right now. And every 4 days I'll mix up a fresh batch, but I'm spraying that on my plants daily. Not just a good mist, just spraying it on them. Nothing crazy, but one time a day, just because I see the results. I see those plants stiffen up. I see that they just look better. There's a little bit of spacing between the nodes. You see them, grow a little bit. And the color's always looking good. So as I said on this show before, I've gotten down to where I just use JLF and fermented plant extracts, man. Those are basically the two things that I've been using at all, as a foliar and then as a nutrient with JLF, just trying to minimize as much as I possibly can and see what still works. So, the FPE's got the lab in it. That's why I'm saying that.
Okay. Yeah, that and OHN is something that I use with it pretty regularly. So, and Kevin, you make your own too, right? I believe. You make you fuck with OHN, right?
Yes. Yeah, I make it. Yeah, we've made kind of played around with it. Make OHN white, OHN black. I'd use a vodka and Pabst Blue Ribbon for the white, and then I'd use a Guinness and Black Label rum for the black. They'd come
out a little different. Pabst Blue Ribbon, dude.
Shit.
Mark, do you have anything to add to the labs?
No, I agree with these gentlemen. I mean, I think it's got a misnomer. It's like it can be a negative thing, but I totally agree with what Johnny's saying, where it's not necessarily like a frequency concern, because it really isn't. It's about a volume and like dosage concern. It's about making sure that you've got the proper dilution rate, making sure that you're not overdoing it. Because if you're overdoing it as far as how much you're giving them plus how often you're doing it, that's when all of a sudden, you start kicking yourself in the ass, because you don't know what's going on and it's yourself causing issues. So
yeah,
there is definitely an essence of less is more when it comes to stuff like labs. But I think that when you practice restraint when it comes to how much you're giving, there really is no concern.
My spray is about 1 ounce, maybe to 2 ounces, but about 1 ounce to a gallon. And that's what I spray. So it's not a heavy spray at all. But
it's That sounds good. Yeah, I mean, that's typically like what the FPE rate is, about an ounce a gallon. So that's nice.
So before we sign off, I just wanted to, obviously, Johnny, huge thank you for spending some time with us tonight.
Yeah, absolutely.
And coming up in the next few weeks, we've got some really awesome guests. Next week, we've got Terraganics, one of the, I don't know what they call themselves now that they've restructured as a business, but Terraganics used to be this I am, you know, big conglomerate going after, you know, big accounts, and now they're kind of, it seemed they've changed ownership, and now they've got kind of a different mission where they're actually going around, they're trying to help people, they're trying to, you know, reach people on not just a small scale grow, but on big scale commercial, where they help people actually cut costs. You know, an EM is one of those products where you buy it once, it's regenerative, you use it over and over again. And their whole platform is teaching people how to do that program. So I'm kind of excited about that discussion with EM. And her name is Jasa Kraus. She's one of the principals of the company. I don't know if she's like one of the owners, but she's a very, very knowledgeable person who can speak really well on the regenerative side, how we can use it better. Really excited for that one. That's going to be next week. And in 2 weeks, December 13th, got to look it up here. I'm so sorry, guys.
This is actually where I got the recipe for my fermented plant extract. It was off their website. So they have if you're looking for a simple way to make a fermented plant extract, go on the Cherry Organics website, type in alfalfa, like on the search thing, and it'll show you a recipe for that, or just type in fermented plant extract, it should come up too. That way you can get your ratios and you make it and just scale it however you want it to whatever size container. But they have one specific, they have one specific for alfalfa fermented plant extract, which is how I followed this, except I use labs instead of EM1.
Yeah, their website is chock full of amazing, amazing.
Some good resources.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so sorry, I forgot about the... you know, the one and only Brandon Rust coming on December 13th. He's coming on to talk about carbon, its role in making inputs, and kind of just share some more information on success in organic gardening using carbon, which is how they're, you know, at Bokashi Earthworks. That's the entire premise of what they do is utilizing carbon more. Carbon-based inputs is what they call them. So really excited to talk with Brandon, to catch up with him. And then after that, we've got Mackie coming on from High on Homegrown. He's going to be really fun to talk with, kind of see where home growing is going, kind of where we've been in 24 since he's got his fingers on the pulse of this thing. And then we've also got Dragonfly Earth Medicine lined up to come on as well, just trying to dial in a date. So really, really full of knowledge on regenerative closed loop farming, so much so that they have an entire program for people to follow, for you to actually get certified. Truly people that are carrying a very bright torch in this community. And we really look forward to having the opportunity to sit down with these guys. And beyond that, let's get a breakdown. Johnny, mindfullyrooted.com, correct?
.org. The site's not really up and running too much at the moment. I have to figure out some logistical stuff with it. So that's kind of in the works. Something when I have a little bit more time, I got to figure that stuff out. But I think the blog posts and things should still be up. I just haven't been really too active on there. But there's a good write-up on making JMS and some other videos that you can take a look at for some basic information. But that's something that's in the works for me that I want to start getting back into for next year's writing up a little bit more information on there.
And definitely give him a follow on Instagram at Mindfully Rooted. He throws up some gems from time to time that, and also if you just go back through his library, it's full of amazing information. So if like, you know, apartment growing connected with you, definitely scroll back. If, you know, transitioning from SoCal to the Northwest connected with you, scroll back, check out his Instagram and hit the DM if you got questions. I mean, I feel like you're a super approachable guy. Absolutely. Love talking with you. Kevin, what do you got going on, brother?
Yeah, Johnny, thank you for being here, man. Often I'll type in MI beneficials to tag Mark and I hit I hit MI and it pulls Mindfully Rooted up first, and I just hit the button. I'm like, boom, and I'm like, oh, dude, I did it again.
So, you got algorithm preferences, dude.
He's probably like, dude, you do that way too many times.
I'll give a shit, man. I'll promote your stuff, dude. I know what you're about. I'm cool with it.
Yeah, I appreciate it too, man. So yeah, thanks for all you do. Thanks for your kind voice. You know, your soft heart that you have. Teach, very, very teachable guy, and a guy who likes to teach. So. Y'all go out to okcalicshop.com for another few hours. I got the genetics bundle up. It's 130 seeds. That's 90 regs, 40 fems for $125, a genetics bundle. It's got all kinds of good stuff in there. Okcalicshop.com. I got IMO3, Bokashi, the IMO3 starter pack. Everything is super cheap. All the genetics are cheap. So go check it all out. Check these boys' stuff out. I just bought, you know, we're on this show together, and we're legit. I want to tell you, I buy Mark's stuff. I haven't bought isopods because I don't have a reason for them right now. When I do, I'm talking to Brian. But right now, I'm getting fungus gnats in my indoor grow. Right, first thing I thought of was freaking fungus gnat eliminator, because I got it last year for my indoor grow, and Mark was like, "Just sprinkle this on, dude. I promise you, they're gonna be gone." I've never had an indoor grow that didn't have fungus gnats. And I mean swarms of fungus gnats, dude. I'm talking, damn. I just kind of keep it quiet amongst my grower friends and just get it over with sometimes. But when I put that bio gnat or that fungus gnat eliminator in last time, I'm telling you, within 5 days, I saw nothing anymore. And then I never saw anything again for the rest of my indoor grow. So I'm going to hit it early. I ordered my biofungus, my fungus gnat eliminator packs from MI Beneficials because it works, y'all. So legit. Brian, what about you?
Yeah, it's a nice little segue. Definitely MI Beneficials, you know, I've been using those products for years. I mean, part of the business why I sell the products is using Johnny's IMO. I think part of the reason that IMOs aren't really kicking off yet in the world that I'm in now is it almost sounds too good to be true. And so that's why I appreciate you guys when we do these shows, so that we can eventually start to educate a consumer base that's brand new to a lot of this stuff. The same way I felt like we were maybe in 2015, 2016, where reusing your soil sounded too good to be true. And I think once you start to understand this stuff from a whole nother level, even growing in a farm, in an apartment to a house, to eventually hopefully like a farm type setup. That's a goal for a lot of us that are sitting here on a Friday night hanging out together. And I think having Johnny on here tonight shows you that progression is real. There are a lot of people that are trying to figure things out in the early days of like when COVID was going on and stuff. And I'm just excited to see Johnny. You have a little bit of swagger to you, man. I can see that you found your lane. You know where you're at. And it's cool to see, man. You can't fake that kind of stuff. And even from the early days, man, everybody knew that you were onto something. You've shared it with the community for so long. We appreciate it. And then moving forward, I use Johnny's stuff. That's obviously a secret sauce if you're newer to this. Building up IMOs, I'm using Mark's stuff for years now to make sure that when I go downstairs and when my wife goes downstairs, that she's excited about all the bugs that we do have in our house and doesn't notice the bullshit ones because we're aggressively using Mother Nature. And I think that's what IMOs is. Using that is a weird way to say that. IMOs are using diversity to kind of do kind of that sick, same dude. Thing.
IMOs.
IMOs, yeah. Somebody should that's like, steal that.
That might be Johnny. And then you get Chris Drum.
All right, so Mark, you want to head us out here, man. And Friday nights have become, the hangouts. So if you guys are really into what we're teaching, this is something special, I think, that people are able to break down in an hour, maybe 90 minutes sometimes.
Yeah, I really appreciate everyone's time. We've got a Black Friday sale going on at mibeneficials.com. 30% off our Rove Beals, our biodiversity packs, which are the fungus net eliminator, and then all of our springtails are 30% off. And we also have a promotion running where if you spend $200, you get a free hoodie. And you get to pick whichever one are MI Beneficials, Friends with Benefits, or the Springtail hoodie, which those are $50. And just so people understand, like I don't order my stuff off of Vistaprint. You know, I I have a friend in the community here that I send my stuff through. So I don't buy the cheap blanks. I don't buy the cheap workmanship. I don't buy the cheap transfers. This is the stuff that'll wash forever. It's like, so I hope people understand, you know, like, when you shop small business, you're supporting community. You're not just supporting me, but you're supporting people like MI Beneficials, like Rubber Ducky Isopods, like OK Calyx. When you support us, it goes a lot further than supporting businesses that couldn't give two shits less about what you're buying or how much, because it really is just a drop in the bucket. So I hope you guys understand that, you know, the support from the show, the support through the businesses, it really means the world to the 3/4 of us. And it's what keeps us going every week to keep coming back on Friday nights and spend this time with you guys. So, with that, I hope you all have a great night. Stay mindfully rooted. And practice.
Like we use that.
Start practicing your inputs now, guys, because it's not a time to start practicing when it comes to spring. Keep the process going, keep practicing, and keep mindfully rooted. Have a good night, guys.
Yep.